The United States Army Air Force is off for Berlin.
Ready for war, sir. Ready for war.
The magnificence of the courage and fortitude of the Korean people defies description.
Other battles were raging in the streets of Saigon.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
There has been unusual American air activity in the area of the Persian Gulf.
We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential.
Afghanistan is a war that we had to fight and we have to win.
This is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join our honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
To the present day.
In Afghanistan and Iraq, 50 million people are now living in freedom.
Now, the American Veterans Center and Radio America present Veterans Chronicles.
Good evening from the White House in Washington, D.C. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
On Sunday, June 25th, Communist forces attacked the Republic of Korea. This attack has made it clear beyond all doubt that the international communist movement is willing to use armed invasion to conquer independent nations. This challenge has been presented squarely. We must meet it squarely.
This week on Veterans Chronicles, host Paul Berry is spending time with retired U.S. Marine Lieutenant General Bernard Traynor.
But back then, sir, it was Lieutenant Traynor, 24 years old,
yeah,
in Korea.
Yeah.
How did I get here? What were you thinking? What was going on?
Well, I was a second lieutenant, fresh out of the Marine Corps Basic School at Quantico. I'd been commissioned in 51, went through officer training down there, finished in December, and was sent out as a replacement officer to the 1st Marine Division, which had taken quite a few officer casualties, and ended up with the 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, on a hill called 749 on the east coast of Korea, which was just above the Soyanggang River. And it was mountainous, and it was snow. It was bitterly, bitterly cold. Very little civilization there. But the Marines had fought over this area during the previous autumn and into the winter. Then the peace talks started, and we kind of had a stalemate, which began what known as the Outpost War. They were on to the north of us, and we were the south, and we just went back and forth at one another. At that time, the Marines, were facing the North Koreans. Later on, when we went to the West Coast, we faced the Chinese. But here was the North Koreans. I had arrived, and, you know, I was just exhausted there was an air draft that took us out there and took over my rifle platoon, 2nd platoon of Charlie Company, and I didn't really know what I was doing. I was very, very uncertain of myself. I wasn't physically scared, but I was afraid that I would not measure up, and that was the big thing. And I think that was the case of the platoon sergeant and my platoon. They didn't know whether this guy was going to measure up either, brand new second lieutenant.
Could you feel that tension?
Oh, yes, no question about it. I was, when I arrived, the first thing I said to my platoon sergeant, I said, I'd like to see the positions. And we had a little dugout in the back of the hill, and the troops were in these trench lines in the front, almost like World War I. And so I thought he would escort me out and show me around. He says, they're out there, Lieutenant. I got the message right then and there. You're not in charge here, Lieutenant. Not yet. And for a while, I was completely ignored, and the troops would simply look to the platoon sergeant. And finally, I tell you, when I finally won my spurs, if you will, We were going to be in support of the company next to us, who was going to make a raid on what was known as Luke's Castle. It was a hard point position that the North Koreans held, and my platoon was going to provide the base of fire for them, support them in the attack. So I did a kind of a map study as to where I thought we could best place ourselves for this attack, and then I went out to physically take a look at it, and we put these white sheets on. My platoon sergeant and I went out with him, and I figured, this looks pretty good, and I turned to him. Wagner, his name was, what do you think, Wagner? And he didn't even look at me, he just kind of looked into the distance and says, I don't know, Lieutenant, you're the platoon leader. And right then and there, I knew he had passed the baton of command at that time, but not up until then. He had to get, you know, it was his platoon. He didn't want this new guy taking over and not know what he was doing. But right then and there, I took charge of the platoon. Unfortunately, he was killed later.
That was
on.
Bernard Wagner, right?
I'm sorry?
Bernard Wagner was his name? Was it?
Harold Wagner.
Harold Wagner.
Yeah.
Yes.
West Virginia. He was killed later on.
You took responsibility for that, General, didn't you? You said he was killed because...
Oh, that was, yes, that was months later on the West Coast, and we were going out on a patrol, and he was in with the point. The lead, the four guys in front, and we had just gone through the wire, and it was at night. It was in the dark, and the Chinese were laying in ambush. It was just outside of our position. They opened up with Burke guns, and they got all four on the point. And I faulted myself because I had inadvertently got in the habit of going in and out of the wire at the same location. The Chinese were smart. They watched us, and they knew that we were doing that so that they were able to sneak up under cover of darkness and lay in wait at this opening in the barbed wire that we invariably came through. It was a mistake. It was a mistake that I still live with, in that we should have varied. And one of the things I learned later on paid off for me was that always vary your routes. Don't get into a routine that because the enemy is always watching and they'll take advantage of it. And they took advantage of it in this instance, and it cost me four lives, including the life of my platoon sergeant.
When you were in Korea, sir, you... were you 24 years old? What did you think was going to happen to you in the Marines? What did you think was going to happen in the Marines? Where did you think you were going?
Oh, I wasn't thinking that far ahead. I really had no intention at that time in making the Marine Corps a career. My only interest was, you know, doing the job and getting out of there and going back home. And I figured, you know, I would do whatever remaining time I had on my initial assignment within the Marines, which I think was 3 years, if I recall. And then I figured I'd probably go out. I thought maybe getting into the advertising business, possibly going back and getting an advanced degree and teaching history someplace. I never thought I'd stay in the Marines. But at that point, I was not thinking that far ahead. It was just survive and do the job during my year's tour out there.
Why were you in the Marines in the first place?
Well, I had enlisted in the Marines right at the end of World War II.
Why?
Well, because it was the thing to do. It was the big war. My brother and all the kids in the neighborhood who were a year or more older than me were in the military, and I was one of the few people in World War II that was disappointed that the war ended before I got an opportunity to get in it. So I enlisted in the Marines anyway. I was on a draft to go to China at the end of the war. For the occupation duty in China when I was pulled off the draft because I had taken a test, and they picked me up for officer training and sent me to what was then known as the Holloway Program, which is now the Naval ROTC, and they sent me off to college to get a degree and a commission. I went to Holy Cross College in Worcester, Massachusetts, and so I got in by default, really, got the education, and obviously I was committed to the Marines, but I wasn't committed in a career sense. I was, you know, just going to do my job. I'll get my shot at the war in Korea, and then get out.
How did the men feel? How did you feel? How did they feel, enlisted and officers, about being in Korea? Did it make sense?
Well, when I first got out there, all of the Marines were volunteers. Later on, we got our first draftees, got five draftees in. But the troops, typical troops, and I think that's the same way today. It certainly was throughout the rest of my career. They're there. You know, they're going to do the job. There wasn't any kind of emotion on the grand strategic scheme. Why are we here? I don't agree with this war. I do agree with this war. We're stopping communism. Their world is very small. They're small. It's exactly the unit they're with, the people that they're tied in with, and as far as they can see. That was the world that we lived in, and that was enough of a world for all of us.
How long did you stay in Korea before you got out, and then what happened?
Well, when I came back, at the end of my tour, I came back and went down to the 2nd Marine Division at Camp Lejeune, and then went on sea duty on the heavy cruiser, and I was a bachelor, and I was, at that point, I was kind of enjoying the military life. I had no ties, so I stayed in, and it was one of these things, I'll stay in a little bit longer, and then that turned out to be a 40-year career.
Did you make friends and stay in touch with friends from Korea? Did you?
I still have friends that I knew out there, and still in touch with them. A lot of them have passed away since then. But in every step that I went, I made friends that have long lasted. I had an exchange tour with the British Royal Marine Commandos for a year, and made some very good friends with the Brits that I still am in touch with. Yeah, so it's one of these. It's like a string of DNA. You're with them for the rest of your life.
How do you, when you all hear 50, 60 years later, and the issue in Korea is as it is? You weren't political. You were military. You're doing your job.
Yeah.
But you were there for a purpose.
That's right.
Did you serve that purpose, and what do you think?
Oh, I think so, yeah. And, I'm sorry we didn't win the war, but I certainly, in retrospect, would not take the position of Douglas MacArthur that we're going to drop atomic bombs and wipe out China. I think we did the best we possibly could. It was the first of the wars, the limited wars, that marked the Cold War. Vietnam being another one that you're not really there to win a war in the classic sense. You're in there to do a job and to stop the enemy aggression and come to some sort of a limited agreement for a ceasefire.
We're talking with Bernard E. Traynor, Lieutenant General, retired Marine Corps. We'll be back with more.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Radio America and the American Veterans Center. This is Veterans Chronicles.
52 of the 59 countries which are members of the United Nations have given their support to the action taken by the Security Council to restore peace in Korea. We have sent land, sea, and air forces to assist in these operations.
This week on Veterans Chronicles, host Paul Berry is spending time with retired U.S. Marine Lieutenant General Bernard Traynor. Born in New York City in September 1928, Traynor enlisted in the Marine Corps after high school and in 1947 was selected as a midshipman in the Naval ROTC. 4 years later, in 1951, he was commissioned a Marine Second Lieutenant and in December of that year was assigned to the 1st Battalion, 1st Marine Division in Korea, where he served as an infantry platoon commander. Back in the United States in September 1952, he served with the 8th Marine, 2nd Marine Division at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. In June 1953, he was aboard the heavy cruiser USS Columbus, where he served consecutively as executive officer and commanding officer of the ship's Marine Detachment. During this two-year tour of duty, he was promoted to captain. All told, Traynor served in the Marine Corps for 39 years. More recently, you may have seen him on television as a military analyst for NBC, and he's the author of two books. Now, more of our interview with retired U.S. Marine Lieutenant General Bernard Traynor and your host, Paul Berry.
So now it's goodbye, Maria. I'm off to Korea, far across the sea. It's the same old story, and it's up to old glory to win another fight for liberty. So keep the home fires burning, and it won't be long until I'll be returning. Goodbye, Maria, though I'm off to Korea. In my heart, you'll always be my Marie.
You had now been through a second campaign, if you will, where we, Americans, fought a limited engagement. We did not use all of our resources. We didn't do everything we could have done to win. And maybe we couldn't use. Obviously, we didn't.
Yeah.
But you didn't stop there. You could have walked away from the Marine Corps. What was your thinking then?
Oh, well, you know, once again, you're a professional soldier. And your job is not to judge the politics and the decision making of the command authority, national command authority. You're a professional soldier and you do what you're told to do. And you expect your troops to do that. And don't give it a second to you have your personal opinion of it as to what the outcome should be and how it could be different. But your job is to carry out your mission. And that was basically it. And, you know, we in the Marine Corps, we were pretty critical of Westmoreland. Westmoreland had this desire to go out into the hills and track down the VC and the North Vietnamese in the middle of nowhere. And attrit them. Well, they were having babies faster than we were, so the attrition thing wasn't going to work. The Marine Corps approach was, hey, the key to this thing is the people. You got to protect the people, the people out in the farms, protect the farms. And if they want to come down and fight us here, right, we'll beat them here. And if not, leave them up in the hills and they all die of malaria, see? So that was the approach. But Westmoreland, oh no, we have to have these big search and destroy operations, and you go back out into the bush, and people would get killed, and then you'd leave, and they'd come in and reoccupy. It was a terrible strategy, and that didn't change until Westmoreland left and General Abrams came in, and Abrams had the right idea. You protect the people in the populated areas, which is what we did, and that's why I think, you know, we had won the war militarily in the South, but we had lost the war psychologically and political wise at home, and so we came to the conclusion that we withdrew and abandoned the South Vietnamese, I think unfairly and unjustly.
We lost the war at home. We lost the minds, the will of the American people.
We didn't military lose. Politically, we lost it. The Americans lost their will to support this thing. The South Vietnamese government didn't give them any reason to have confidence in them, and we pulled the plug on them and withdrew, and then also withdrew the military aid for them, whereas in the North was getting all this military aid from China and from Russia. So the war ended with their victory over the South Vietnamese, not as a guerrilla war, but as a conventional war with tanks running into downtown Saigon.
As a professional soldier then, coming home from Vietnam and watching Americans treat the American military as losers, How did you feel?
Well, yeah, that's kind of interesting. I think that's been overdone, frankly. You know, if somebody ever spit on me when I got off an airplane, and he would have gotten thumped. And so anybody that didn't thump him, you had to say, well, no wonder you won't lost the war. You're going to tolerate this. No, it didn't. That didn't bother me. You know, I feel, okay, this is America. They're complaining about it. But I think the business of people being ill-treated when they returned, I think that's been overstated, and I think the subsequent kind of reflections by historians confirm that. So, you know, I came back. Of course, I came back into a military community, and it was, you know, we're professional soldiers. We do a professional job. Went out there, and where do we go now? You know, where are we going to send next and do the job? So I was not affected by that particularly, and I kind of looked at it with kind of jaundiced eye anyway.
When you came back, you spent a great deal of time administratively teaching, going involved. Did you enjoy that as much as you enjoyed being out in the field?
Oh no! I mean, when you're a Marine, you want to be in the field. But I had years ago, when I was a young officer, I had this colonel saying, "Trainer, remember this: when there's war, go to war, and when you're not at war, go to school." And it also meant go to school, but also to teach. And that's really the way the military system is, because you come back, you have your basic school, and then you go to an intermediate school, and then you go to advanced school. So you're always either going to school or in the field, and you're also taking your part in being a teacher. Because all officers and all NCOs are, in the final analysis, not only leaders, but they're also teachers. You take, you're almost like a guildsman from the medieval period, where you take this raw material that is given to you by society, and you mold it into the form that you want. And that starts with the drill instructor at boot camp. But that's always the way. And you're mentoring young officers, young NCOs coming along. It's the job of those who are more senior to them to develop them as leaders and as professional fighting men.
And by now, you have spent how many years in the military?
Well, I spent almost 40 years. I think I was 39 some months.
Total years. But then at this point, when you're back from the Vietnam campaign, mm-hmm. and you're teaching and you're in administration, you've been now. Do you see yourself now as a career military man?
There's no question.
You're
about
seeing that.
I mean, yeah.
Now, no. So here's my question. And are you saying, I wonder if I could make general?
Yeah.
Are you?
Yeah, sure.
You want that?
Yeah, well, you know, you go through a period. First of all, your family counts an awful lot. I didn't marry young. I was married before Vietnam. Left my wife with babies when I went to Vietnam. On both instances, we had four daughters. But your wife has to be part of this team also. See that if she doesn't like it, at least tolerate it. But you have to take the family into consideration, and you have a stage where at 20 years. Should I get out at 20, you're probably a lieutenant colonel, and start a brand new career. But then you say, well, if I like it and I feel that, you know, I have a chance of making colonel, I'll do that. And then your next stage is usually at 26 years. Then you have to say to yourself, I'm a colonel. What's my chances of making general? If not, I ought to get out now so I'm still young enough to start a second career and go out as a colonel on 26. And I took to myself, you know, I had a good record both in terms of combat and in the command and staff jobs that I had. And I figured, okay, probably the top 5 or 10% stand a chance of making general. And I felt I was competitive. Talked to my wife and I said, you know, I'll stay in and give it a shot for general. And then I was successful.
When you were notified, when you got the orders, when all of it, here, it's going to be general trainer. What did that feel like?
Well, it felt pretty good, but pretty humble also. My mother, I grew up in the Bronx, and I told my mother, she was an Irish, you know, mother, and she didn't want me to get too full of myself. She said, would I tell you that Timmy Gulhooly was made head motorman on the IRT? You know, there it is. You're not the only one that's made it.
But it must have felt that you'd made the right decision. Here you are.
But then you feel the sense of responsibility. Holy Moses, almost like being a second lieutenant again. Jesus, I'm a general. God, I hope I can cut it. You know, maybe you're not worried in the same sense as when you're a lieutenant, but you're also saying to yourself, God, I hope I don't screw this one up.
Brigadier General Trainer, that sounded pretty good.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good.
And we are heading now into the, we're headed now into the next war. You're teaching at this point, are you?
Well, no, at that time, you know, I had done the, I had on and off at the teaching, but also my, I was also in the planning business. I was big on the plans and operations. I had done a lot of work, you know, for the Marine Corps with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So I was, there was that. I had two routes, really. It was the professional education route and also the plans and operations route for joint operations. And so, but then I got sent down to Paris Island to recruit training business.
So you went into the recruiting business.
Yeah.
When we come back, let's talk about the recruitment of young men. You saw that raw material.
Yeah.
And you knew that you were going to send them off to war, and some of them would not come back.
Yeah,
I don't know how you feel when we
had
back.
Some real problems.
General, you had the opportunity to go into the recruitment part of the business that all militaries have to worry. You have to bring men in, people and men and women. When you looked at this raw material that you knew you were sending off to war, what went in your mind?
Well, I got in the recruiting business before I made Brigadier General. And what had happened at the end of the Vietnam War, the military was in low regard in the part of the American people, and the draft ended. We went to an all volunteer force, but the recruiters had a terrible difficulty recruiting because up to that point they had been simply order takers. They hadn't had to go out and recruit, and nobody wanted to go in the military. So the end result, and they were held under pressure to make quotas. You have to get so many people. And they go to the jailhouses and the judges, and they go to the bar rooms, and they recruit trash. So we were bringing in a lot of people that today you never get in the military. Okay, so that was a problem. We were bringing in a lot of troublemakers. Now we would send them down to recruit training to turn them into Marines. But all they did, all we were doing was moving troublemakers from the recruiting station to the recruit training station. And then the drill instructors were having a terrible time with these people, which led to a lot of abuse on the part of the drill instructors out of frustration. So all of the services were suffering terribly from this thing, and there was the drug problem, and there was the racial problem embedded in this post-Vietnam period. And then it took the Marine Corps about 7 years, I think it took the Army even longer than that, to recover from this. And we purged the system of people who should not have been in there. And then we started to recruit quality and train them without abuse. We cut down the ratio to drill instructor to recruit. But it took us about 7 years to grow a new Marine Corps with qualified NCOs and with good, loyal troopers, and which then paid off when we went out in the Gulf War in 1990. It was a long, tough struggle. The Army went through it. The Navy went through it. All of the services went through it. It was the result of the Vietnamese War and the fact that the military had fallen to in such low regard in the United States. But thank God we came out of it, and hope we never go through that problem again.
And we're back with great men and women
today.
Oh,
they're terrific today. Absolutely terrific.
You have so many memories, sir, over the years that you served, and we thank you for that service. But I guess I would leave you with this question. Of everything that you can remember, everything that has been important to you, what stands out in your mind as the most memorable of your
question about Korea. That's where all is brand new, tabula rasa. And, you know, everything that happened stayed with me. But that was such a fierce period when I was out there. It was, as they say, an outpost. Well, the North Koreans and the Chinese were on one side, and we were on the other side, face treadline, and no man's land in between like World War One, except for outposts. That's why it was called the Outpost War. And what would happen is that we would put small units, usually a squad at the very least, and usually a platoon out on these hills in no man's land, and they would have the same thing on the other side. And for a couple of years there, all we did was fight back and forth for control of the outpost for dominant terrain in the event of a ceasefire. So let me tell you, you would be out on this hill, and you'd have trench lines and bunkers dug there and covered with sandbags, and you're on your own, you'd have your communications, and the Chinese decided that they were going to try to take you, they would attack you with mortars and artillery and attack at night, and you were out there and you were calling in your artillery, and it was just back and forth, and then the battle would go on for 2 or 3 days, and you'd either still have the hill or they'd have the hill, and you'd counterattack. This went on for a 2-year period with horrendous casualties.
How did you maintain your sanity, Jose?
Well, once again, by that time I felt I was a pretty seasoned trooper. I'd fought on the East Coast, now I was fighting on the West Coast, just above the peace talk places at Panmunjom. And you did, you wondered, how the hell am I going to handle this sort of thing? It was pretty discouraging, but you hung in there.
Would you do it over again?
Sure, in a second.
Lieutenant General retired Bernard D. Trainer, thank you for your service.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.